From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Today on the show, we're discussing several emerging wine regions and grapes that maybe you heard of, but you're not so familiar with all the ins and outs. Jonathan Gold stops by to discuss that timeless argument here in L.A. Does the West Side or the East Side have better food? And where is the dividing line anyway? But first, as always, let's check in with Laura Avery, who's at the Santa Monica Farmers Market with a look at what's fresh and in season this first week of February.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're visiting with Rhea Wilson, who is the sous chef at the recently opened Squirrel, the wonderful cafe that Jessica Coslow, master jam maker, food preserver, opened just recently in Silver Lake. And Rhea, you're here at the market. You're getting items for the cafe. And tell us what you're looking at right now and what dish you might be creating with something here.
There's a lot of really cool things, green garlic, cardoons, stinging nettles as well. Something that we've done actually this past week is a green garlic and nettle frittata with German butterball potatoes, and that's been really, really great.
So the green garlic is literally the plant before it turns into a hard bulb, but looks kind of like a scallion. And then when you use a green garlic, apparently what I hear is it's milder, and yet you can use the whole plant.
Yes, everything from the bottom to the top, and it's so mild. We've actually put it raw in some applications as well. So.
And the nettles also. Now, Peter Shaner has all this great green garlic. Is he also the guy with the nettles?
We are actually getting our nettles from Florabella right now.
And when you handle the nettles, can you physically pick them up in your bare hands, or do you let the guys do that?
I glove, depending on how hard they sting, double glove, but it definitely gets you.
But once they're cooked, all that's gone.
Yes, all the sting goes away.
Well, this sounds really great, and we love it that the green garlic now is this wonderful, fresh, seasonal, midwinter, early spring kind of thing. So great to get that inspiration from you.
Awesome, thank you.
That was Rhea Wilson. She's the sous chef at Squirrel, the cafe in Silver Lake that Jessica Coslow opened recently, getting delicious ingredients here at the market to make their frittatas. Peter Shaner is the farmer, among a few others, who is growing the green garlic right now. It's very seasonal. And Peter, you've got not only the green garlic, you've also got the spring onions on your table. So tell us about how they grow and how they taste and how you harvest them.
The green onions is, we plant it from seed, and then we plant the plant out, and then we just pull them early so that you could eat them any way you want for onions. They're tender. The garlic, we plant the cloves on each individual garlic. We plant a clove, and then when it gets big enough to pull as green garlic, we pull it, and then you can chop up the whole thing. It's not as strong as your cloves yet because your flavor's throughout the whole plant. You could chop it up from tip to tip. And if it's even really fresh, where the roots are still fresh and not dried up, you could even use the roots. So it's tender, and then it's not as pungent as the clove garlic because it's the flavor throughout the whole plant. You can use it fresh in salads. You can saute it and use it in vegetable dishes or saute it in butter for garlic bread. Just everything you do regular garlic with, but just different.
Yeah, and then so you're actually sort of thinning your rows because the garlic that you don't pull, is that going to turn into big garlic heads?
Yes, the garlic that we don't pull, we leave it in the ground to mature into big cloves. But since a lot of people and a lot of chefs like the green garlic, we'll pull whole fields. We'll just plant garlic just for the green garlic. They'll want to clean out our whole fields because they like it so much.
So if you're planting one little clove for one little plant, if you let that grow longer, you'd have a whole head. So this is
a bunch of cloves, yes.
Cost a little more because it's one clove per stem.
Yes, it does cost a little more, but we're pulling it early, so it's not in the ground. You know, we have to leave this in the ground for another 4, maybe even 6 months. So we're pulling, getting it out of the ground early. We're saving on water. We're saving on weeding labor. It extends our harvest time, you know, so we're harvesting when it's green and we're harvesting the same thing when it's dry. So it's extending our harvest time. So for us, it's a financially good move.
And you must be succession planting it so you have it coming along for many, many weeks.
You can see right now, Laura, you have two different sizes of garlic. One's mm-hmm. tall and one's long. We planted this in August and we planted this in October.
Oh.
You'll notice that the cloves, the bulb end part of it is about the same size. It's not that much bigger. Because this will make the clove, the bulb of garlic, at the same time this will. They make the bulb according to the daylight hours of a day. So if you plant it early or if you plant it late, it'll still make its bulb at the same time of the year. Oh. If you plant it early and you're going to get a big, healthy plant, you'll get a big bulb of garlic at the end. If you plant it later in the season, which like is January, like right now, your plant won't be as big and healthy, but you'll still get a bulb of garlic at the end, and it'll be smaller.
Oh, wow. So it's the length of the day that the garlic knows what to... Oh, my goodness. Wow. So, yeah, and it's very plentiful, and you're going to have it all the way through...
Through the spring, yes.
Okay, all right. And it's very adaptable, too, and I'm just wondering if I can make it in my my garlic-flavored popcorn topping.
Oh, easily. Okay. Yeah, chop it up and put it in with popcorn, with your butter.
Right. All right, well, Peter, thank you so much.
Thank you, Laura.
That was Peter Shaner. His farm is actually down in Valley Center, and he's a big popular farmer here at the Wednesday Market with many chefs and customers, and has some of the first green garlic. This is that time of year yet again when we come to you, the listener, and ask for your support for Good Food and for KCRW. And now that we can sign up for the monthly payment on our credit card, we can sign up literally one time, and then you're going to have your membership taken care of year-round. You can listen guilt-free all year-round and never have to worry about signing up. So please join me and pledge today. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Go right ahead and find a green garlic recipe from Squirrel Cafe over on the Good Food blog. This week's episode of Good Food is shorter than usual. That's because it's our winter pledge drive when we ask you, our listeners, to support the programming you love here on KCRW. Everything you hear here on the show, the recipes, the stories, the restaurant suggestions, are all made possible by you, by listener support. And this is my quick plea to ask you to join KCRW today and listen as a member. It isn't so painful. Just call 1-800-600-KCRW. You can do it right now or go to kcrw.com/join to make a donation today. Now let's get back to the food. Every pledge drive, I look forward to hearing more about wine from Stacy Hunt. Stacy comes to us from Duvan Wine and Spirits, as well as Splash Productions, and her wine package premiums are always both delicious, educational, and very popular. For instance, this time she selected three bottles from emerging wine regions that are just now peeking out into the limelight.
Number one, a Beaujolais from Beaujolais, France.
Now, when you say Beaujolais, I'm sort of puzzled by the fact that you are classifying it as, quote, emerging. It seems to have painted the town red already.
Well, it was started actually by the Romans, so it's not exactly emerging in the sense that it hasn't been there. But when we think of Beaujolais, we tend to jump immediately to Beaujolais Nouveau. Beaujolais Nouveau is not Cru Beaujolais. CRU. Cru Beaujolais are Beaujolais vineyards that have been designated as crus that have specific appellations, rules, and regulations, and the wine is aged. It's not the bubblegum, tropical, juicy fruit Beaujolais Nouveau that's released every year around November. The grape is Gamay. Gamay is a wine grape that has been sort of kicked around, you know, all over California, all over France, and then some places in the Southern Hemisphere. People have never quite regarded it with, let's say, the quality of like a Grenache or a Cabernet or something like that. But Gamay has a very interesting character to it, one that when made in a very special and careful way, like the Cru Beaujolais, can start to be rich but light wine, a little bit like when you think of Pinot Noir from Burgundy. You pour it in the glass and it looks light colored and kind of lightweight. And you say, well, this is a light wine. And then you put it into your mouth and it's got some heft to it. So this one comes from Morgon, which is one of the 10 Cru Beaujolais. And the grape again is 100% Gamay. And it comes from very old vines.
Interesting. And that's a 2011.
It's a 2011.
Okay. Now, what is our second category?
Going over to Spain. Again, an ancient grape called Pedro Ximenez, or you might see it listed as PX or Pedro X on a label, that label primarily being either sherry or sherry vinegar, has now been vinified into a dry but wonderfully fruity white wine coming out of Jerez, Spain. And there are only a few hundred cases of this floating around in the United States. And I garnered enough bottles for our program. So it is a vinified dry white wine made from Pedro Ximenez grape, which is primarily always just found in sherry as an oxidized grape or in vinegar as, you know, sort of the wonderful acid flavor. So here we've got the acid of the grape, which keeps your mouth fresh, but we've got wonderful fruit in the category of citrus and honeysuckle in the taste.
Wow, that's really fun. That's going to be definitely something new for a lot of people.
And the way to serve it, I think, is with shellfish. And I would recommend it with any type of shrimp or any type of mussel or even with lobster. And I say lobster because lobster is very sweet tasting. And this, although not sweet, has enough fruit in it that I think it will complement the lobster.
Fantastic. And so the third bottle of the package?
Has a wonderful name. It's called Buza. Buza Tanat. And this comes from Uruguay. Now, Uruguay is the flip side of Argentina. Whereas Argentine wines and vineyards are generally altitude, you know, and dry. And the winemaking is quite new world and quite modern. And therefore, alcohol content is a little high. Now, think of Uruguay as marine or maritime. So almost as though if it were growing along the coastline of California. And this wine is done in an old style. I would think of it kind of like northern Spain or Bordeaux style. The Tanat, you may have been reading a lot about it recently in the last few years. It's been discovered as having the most packed antioxidants of any wine grape around, or any grape around. And its primary home has been in the Madiran in France, where it's kind of what I would call an itchy, scratchy red wine, like wearing wool. And this one is more like wearing cashmere. The wine has been refined because I think of the soils and the weather and the hemisphere in Uruguay, which is Mediterranean influenced. And so the wine, although not new world high alcohol, it kind of falls into this lower alcohol wine category that people are gravitating towards. And I think people will enjoy this wine as a very unusual and different taste. The grape, again, is Tanat.
It's a red wine.
It is a red wine.
And what do you think would be the best pairing for it?
Well, I think it deserves to have something red with it, like meat, like a beef. I also think it works very well with pork, and I think it's quite good with lamb, particularly if you want to stud it with a lot of garlic and some thyme and rosemary. It tends to do very well with garlic.
That's fantastic. Thank you so much, Stacy.
My pleasure.
Stacy Hunt comes to us from Duvan Wine and Spirits and Splash Productions. A list of all the bottles she mentioned are on the Good Food blog. I'm here with Jet Tila, local boy who grew up in his family's famed Bangkok market and Royal Thai restaurant. He helmed a restaurant on the Strip in Vegas, and now he travels as a restaurant consultant in between appearances on Food TV. We're giving one lucky person and a friend the opportunity to join the Good Food crew on a Thai town tour with Jet. That's right. You'll join me, my producer Jillian, and the rest of our Good Food family as Jet shares the Thai eats of LA with us.
If there's enough Singhai beer, it's going to get pretty raucous. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I think so, too. So we always love when you come here to talk about Thai food. It's been a really long time. Mm-hmm. So given that we're looking ahead to this tour, you know, a lot of folks aren't, you know, Jonathan Gold.
Right.
Acolytes who feel comfortable going into places they've never been before and trying to assess.
Right. And the thing that we know, people that dine a lot and are kind of, you know, quote unquote experts, is in an Asian restaurant, if you order incorrectly, right, your meal has going to be torpedoed. You know, all we can really do is order a few dishes. So if you don't order perfectly, that's the difference between an amazing night out or like, hey, you know, all this hype was for nothing. So what I like to do is I'm going to teach you how to kind of order like an expert. The hallmarks of what to order will kind of help you navigate through a Thai restaurant experience. Right.
First of all, is there some sort of general palate we should expect from Thai restaurants here in LA? I know that a lot of people who eat sort of more mass Thai food expect a lot of sweetness.
Yeah, so the expectation of American palates is we favor slightly sweeter Thai food. And I am in that category for sure. I love my food a little on the sweet side. But as you know, and we've spoken about this for many years, we base it around that principle of yum. Y-U-M. And all that means is the balance point between hot, sour, salty, and sweet. The master flavors. So the Thai restaurant should give you their version of yum without skewing too far one way, except for probably spicy and except for sweet.
So what do we order? We go into a restaurant and often the menus are overwhelmingly huge.
Great. So the first thing before you even order, every Thai restaurant makes one to three dishes the best. So Thai families, like if you and I, we wouldn't sit around and go, let's go eat Thai food. Let's pick a general restaurant. We would say, Evan, what are you craving? And you would say this dish. And
I want greens with pork belly.
Perfect. And then we pick the restaurant that has the best greens with pork belly. And then we build that meal around that. So perfect. So greens with pork belly, we would go to Yai's.
I love Yai.
Right. Best pork belly, triple cooked, you know, a nice kind of airy, crispy skin, a nice velvety, tiny layer of fat, and then a nice kind of a leaner, rich, you know, in Thai we call pork belly mu sam chan, three-layered pork, because the perfect pork belly should have those three perfect layers.
And then the greens there are really forward in your face, a lot of minerality,
yes,
which kind of cuts.
Mm-hmm. Minerality paired with bitterness, which cuts really well into the garlic and the fish sauce. So what do we order? Rice is my first tell of the quality of a restaurant. Jasmine rice has to be served all the time, right? Unless you're in an Isan or a northern restaurant. But people that cheat and go cheap, they use long grain Texas rice. And jasmine rice has this very sexy kind of pearlescence. It's almost like describing a car, right? And Texas long grain has this kind of rougher, opaque, like fatter quality to it. So if it smells like bamboo and if it's a sexy rice, I would look at jasmine.
But what if we're such a newbie that we don't even know that greens with pork belly is a thing we should be craving, and we're just thinking of pad thai? Do we order pad thai
then
in a
restaurant? Let me flip it a little bit. That's a great, great way to put it. If you love pad thai, by all means, order pad thai. But I would prefer you go off the reservation a little bit and order three things, okay? Let me give you the overall. I would order a soup of some kind, tom yum, tom kha, right, which is coconut galanga soup or the hot and sour shrimp soup, and check their yum, right? It should be a nice balance of acid forward, followed by a little salt and a little sweet. And then spicy is up to you. And then I would order pad siu instead of pad thai. So pad thai is rice stick noodles. They're very small, tamarind, kind of a citrusy note. Pad siu is fresh rice noodles in more of a fish sauce and a nice sweet soy sauce. It's the chow fun of Thailand. It really is, literally. And then I would absolutely order a curry, because this is what I look for in a really good curry. Flavor development is key, and viscosity is key. So curry doesn't have to be so thick that it just sits like a glob on top of your rice and won't penetrate.
See, to me, that's very Japanese-style curry.
Agreed, agreed. But then on the opposite end, it shouldn't be so thin where it's like water and runs through, right? Because that means they're not using enough coconut cream and they're being cheap. So we want something right in between. What people don't know is curry is primarily like lemongrass, galanga, and kaffir lime. If you don't get those notes of those three ingredients, it's not a really well-developed curry. So I would be, you know, suspect of the restaurant.
This has been incredible. So you've given us this really amazing education of how to evaluate whether or not a Thai restaurant we found ourselves in is something we should investigate more deeply or pass and try something else the next time.
I love it. It's all about eating like a pro and not wasting your experience.
Thank you so much, Jet.
Always happy to be here.
That was our really good friend, TV personality and chef Jet Tila. You can find more information about Jet's Thai Town tours on the Good Food blog. It's that time when Jonathan Gold pays us a visit. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times and a fixture right here on Good Food, where he always highlights new restaurants week after week. Today, we were inspired by our colleagues in the news department to tackle a subject that foodies love to talk about. I'm talking about East Side versus West Side. Who has the better food, and where is that pesky dividing line?
I've always assumed the dividing line between east and west was the Los Angeles River, because once you cross the river, things are radically different. It's not that they're a little different or they're taking influence from one New York chef as opposed to another New York chef. It's that instead of having, you know, Mexican restaurants that are appealing to a non-Mexican crowd, you get Mexican restaurants that are appealing to a Mexican crowd. You get Chinese restaurants where the chefs are cooking for Chinese.
And then West LA, west of Sepulveda, it's completely different.
Right. I mean, you have some exceptions to that. I mean, there's the pocket of Oaxacan restaurants. There's the pocket of old Mexican restaurants. Obviously, there's the Japanese belt. I hate to call it Little Osaka, but I guess it's Little Osaka. You certainly have a lot of Japanese restaurants, including the best and presumably most authentic ramen place in the city, one of the better soba places, some of the better sushi bars that are cooking very much in a Japanese context, and yet they are on the west side. But you're almost the ideal person to answer this, because you had an Italian restaurant on Melrose, which is central, midtown LA, and you had an Italian restaurant on the west side of Santa Monica, and you had one way west in the Marina.
The customers that came to the cafe on Melrose were on the just beginning upward trajectory of their careers in the movie business. A lot of writers who just wanted to go out and eat. They didn't necessarily want to dine. Then West LA were people who were on the way upward trajectory of their careers. They had the money. They could eat wherever they wanted. And they wanted to dine. And then in the Marina, that was where we would get the people who were in syndication, people who had been in the business for a really long time, finally got the bucks to move to the beach, and they were just happy and relaxed. What's interesting now in West Los Angeles is that it seems like, I mean, what we used to call, I guess now we call it the gastropub, but this idea of the bistro, where it's food that isn't necessarily ethnic food, but you still don't have to pay a fortune for it, and you don't have to dress up to go eat it.
And everything's on tiny share plates. Nothing's that expensive, but by the time you end up paying the check, it's really expensive. And you can get beer that has been hopped within an inch of its life.
But on the other hand, you also can get a great cocktail and a pretty nice selection of wine.
It's true. Good cocktails on the west side is a relatively new phenomenon. In East L.A., you have bars like Eastside Love, which is a wonderful bar, more or less a wine bar in Boyle Heights. It operates pretty much as like a wine bar in any other part of town does, but the people are different, and I'm not sure if the expectations are different at all.
Do you think that on the east side, the restaurants are more neighborhood, and on the west side, they're more destination?
It could be, though there are, of course, destination Chinese restaurants. One of the things that people on the east side are always complaining about, in the same way that people on the west side are complaining that they don't have great Chinese restaurants, where's the great Mexican restaurant? The people on the east side are often, you know, where's the white tablecloth place? Where's the place where I can go for a bistro meal? Where's my gastropub?
I love that. And what is your answer to them?
I shrug pretty much in the same way, although there's a great gastropub in the Lincoln Hotel in Monterey Park just off Garvey that serves taco fries and chashu tacos. It's just a great place, a lot of Japanese beers. But that's very much the exception rather than the norm.
So I know when a lot of us think about east of the river, we're thinking about the San Gabriel Valley and the just unbelievable Chinese food we can get there. So give us a couple of suggestions.
You would be very happy if you ended up at Elite Restaurant in Monterey Park, which has fantastic dim sum in the mornings and afternoons. And then at night, it turns over to a quite elegant Cantonese Hong Kong-style seafood house. In the same sort of elegant vein, Shanghai Number One Seafood, which we've talked about on the show a few times, has sort of spectacular Shanghai-style food.
So now let's do the reverse. Let's talk about a couple of destination restaurants on the west side.
I'm always telling people to go to Javan, the Persian restaurant, which has a really good selection of Persian stews, as well as the kebabs and the rice dishes and such. And I think that you'd probably be happy if you were driving there from Roland Heights.
Javan is on the other side of Westwood, right?
Right. It's very close to the 405. For another kind of food, the Tasting Kitchen on Abbot Kinney. Abbot Kinney is a great street for somebody on the east side wanting to come to the west side. There's a lot to choose from. Or you could go to the new Rose Avenue restaurant scene and go to Superba, which has very nice Italian food and a beautiful patio.
And a lot of good strolling in that neighborhood.
It's a really good walking neighborhood. And I've got to say, I don't do a lot of walking in Monterey Park after dinner.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Jonathan Gold of the LA Times about everyone's favorite rivalry here in the LA food world, East Side versus West Side Eats. Well, what neighborhood do you live in? And what's your favorite local restaurant? Join the conversation on my Facebook page. Search for me, Evan Kleiman, the woman who lives in Mid-City, thank goodness, and click like. And be sure to tune in on Wednesday, February 6th, for more East Side versus West Side banter on Which Way LA. Before I go, I want to make one last plea for your support. This podcast is produced by a public radio station, so you know what that means. We rely on your donations to keep our programming on the air. We talk a lot about community these days, and I have to say that the worldwide membership that makes up the supportive KCRW community is real and powerful. Join it, and you'll be supporting the great shows you love, like us, Good Food. We really can't do it without you. Call 1-800-600-KCRW or go to kcrw.com and click on Join. Good Food's produced by Jillian Ferguson. Laurel Garcia and Sarah Rogozin are our segment producers. The executive producer is Harriet Ells. Thanks to Ronnie Mickelson and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food. And don't forget to become a member today. We really appreciate your support.